Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Media Voices, the media focused podcast that brings you all the news and the views from around the media world. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
Esther, who did you chat to this week?
So this week I spoke to Andy Serwer, who is the editor-in-chief for Yahoo Finance. So we talked about what strategies he's used to grow the publication to become what is now the leader in finance news online, what platforms he uses to reach his business-focused audience, and how they're integrating new technologies like AI into the newsroom. We may also have a little bit of a chat about how financial news has been affected by the crisis in trust. So yeah, tune in a bit.
Before that though, as ever, the news roundup, and we begin with quite a UK-centric news story. The Daily Mail owner has bought the eye from JPI Media, citing synergy potential. So the Daily Mail and General Trust has bought the eye newspaper and website from JPI Media for just under £50 million. The eye sells about 170,000 copies each weekday, while the Mail sells around 1 million, so there's a bit of a disparity there. And while the deal still has to pass the Competition and Markets Authority, and it's possible that they will require the eye to be run independently editorially. In fact, many of the employees have said that they have been given word that it will be editorially independent. Most people expect this to go through.
Who owns the eye now? What?
Yeah, this is their fourth owner in as many years.
In fact, I think we've possibly covered all four owners on this podcast.
When did JPI Media buy it?
So it was actually in November of 2018, wow. Because that's when, I know.
Yeah, but when did he buy it from Lebdibdev?
So that will have been, what, February 2016? That was bought for about $24 million. And the eye has actually performed very solidly over that period.
Yeah, one of the things that I thought was interesting about this is that in the piece that John McCarthy got for The Drum, he says three quarters of the revenue is from the cover price, from copy sales, and just a quarter from advertising.
Yeah, that is a little bit mad when you think about it, isn't it?
That's quite strong on this whole reader revenue play.
I mean, especially given it's not a legacy paper.
Yeah, and Paul Zwillenberg, who's the chief exec of DMGT, has said there would be opportunities to sell advertising that reaches that larger audience in the way we've benefited from combining the Metro and the Mail sales operations.
Yeah, you can see that.
I think this makes sense from a business point of view. You know, it's kind of very solidly profitable.
Okay, now we're getting to it.
Yeah, but... The initial response that I've seen from a lot of people has been to question the idea that it will be left editorially independent. Even if the CMA demands that it is run independently, you know, there's independent and then there's independent.
Well, it's that thing about trust, isn't it, though? Are people going to trust that what they're saying is still independent?
What is it now? Half the UK's daily newspapers are in the hands of two billionaires.
But how does that work? Okay, who's the two billionaires? One is Roop, yeah?
Yeah.
Mr. Mudd. And the other one is Lord Rothermere.
Yep.
But he's the controlling shareholder, but he doesn't actually own the MGT.
What does that matter when he's controlling shareholder?
So I'm not
speaking in defense of billionaires here. Hate's a strong word. I don't like the Daily Mail's editorial position, but I think it's softened a bit since Mr. Dacre moved on. And the story was that Lord Rothermere was a lot less bullish on Brexit than Paul Dacre was. So people have set the Mail up as a kind of boogeyman, and I think, you know, yes.
I thought you were just going to stop there.
I'm not sure that they would see any commercial benefit in turning the eye into the Daily Mail light. You know, they never turned the Metro into the Daily Mail light, or they never made the Metro the Daily Mail light.
Can I be a little... Is this a play because the increasing pressure advertisers are coming under to abandon the Mail to pick up a more commercially viable newspaper?
I think that's a lovely idea, but I don't think that's true.
Yeah, does this make the Stop Funding Hate campaign like job a lot harder?
Gosh, yes.
Well, I
think that there is an increasing awareness among advertisers, especially that there have been more and more people pull out of the Mail over. Not so much recent months, but certainly.
I thought they'd recovered since Mr. Dacre moved on.
Yeah. So they've softened a little bit, but there's still, brands are more aware than ever that the impact that where they choose to advertise and what their behaviour does have an impact on the bottom line because people call them out.
Yep. No.
More so than ever.
I love this idea. I'm just not sure how true it is. I love it.
If you're interested in reading more about the M&A activity this year, we've actually got a report coming out this week, haven't we, boys?
Mm-hmm.
Media Moments 2019 will be dropping on What's New in Publishing, hopefully this coming Wednesday.
God, that sounds awful. This is dropping on What's New in Publishing. It sounds like some kind of really bad piano accident.
I'm just picturing that bomb from Dr. Strangelove and the three of us riding it down. Moving on then, Bloomberg has been issued guidance on covering the new election. Why? Because its owner, Michael Bloomberg, is kicking off his presidential run.
Talking of billionaire media owners.
Yeah.
So Michael Bloomberg, billionaire, he's spending loads and loads of money. He launched his campaign with a £31 million ad buy, which is more than any candidate has ever spent on a single week of political advertising in America, where they spend shitloads on political advertising.
That is a horrendous amount of money to spend on that.
It does make me thankful for the limits in this country that means you can't theoretically do that. I think my favourite take on this was Awa Madawi for The Guardian, and she said, nothing says democracy like a billionaire buying his way into an election to try and unseat another billionaire. You know what else just screams democracy? A presidential candidate owning an eponymous and influential news service that's been barred from criticising him.
Yeah, that's a dream.
That's the kind of dark side of this story. Because the man whose name is on our network is running for Democratic office, we won't investigate him, but we won't investigate any other Democratic candidates. Of course, we will still investigate Trump. And it's like, as much as I hate Trump.
That plays straight into what he's been saying for
exactly
the last 4 years, which is the media are biased against me. They've literally got a witch hunt because you can't, you've got to play the game fairly.
Well, that's almost the definition of witch hunt.
Yeah.
No, it's like a reverse witch hunt. You're not allowed to look in the one house for the witches.
But at the same time, this is a bit of a tricky one because Bloomberg have always had guidance about how they cover Michael Bloomberg and his business stuff because...
Well, every fucking media company's got that.
Absolutely. So when he announced he's running for president, it's a little bit like, it was a bit of a rock and a hard place.
But I mean, thank God we live in the UK where our sitting prime minister wouldn't have any particular ties to any one title or anything like that.
How bad do things have to get when we're thankful for living in the UK?
Well, here's the silver lining of this cloudy sky. I have seen a conspiracy theory that says the only reason that Michael Bloomberg has joined the campaign is because that allows him to spend even more money rubbishing Trump.
Oh, he's doing on attack
advertising,
ads.
Doing attack ads against
Trump. I mean, that's an expensive
Trump.
Hobby.
Well, if you're a billionaire, that's just like me going and buying a new PlayStation.
It's not out till next year. Peter, I love that you have resurrected Conspiracy Corner for this week's episode.
Good luck with your billionaire leaders, America.
Moving on to news in brief, our first three stories are a little bit linked because after all our talk last week about the effects of the information ecosystem collapsing, all kinds of mad stuff happened this week with television media and traditional media. So to begin with, I suppose Tory Party Prime Ministerial candidate Boris Johnson and Brexit Party chairman Nigel Farage were represented by melting ice sculptures in a Channel 4 debate on climate change that they both declined to appear on.
Do you reckon they did shots from them afterwards?
What were the sculptures of? It wasn't like two big chickens, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was
two big cocks.
This was the weirdest part, was that people were genuinely convinced in the hours in the run-up to this debate that Channel 4 had commissioned a life-size sculpture of Boris Johnson from ice. In reality, it was just a kind of a globe with climate change or whatever written on the bottom. It was not. Although, arguably, the ice sculpture would be better at governance. And so after that, the BBC then capitulated to the Conservative Party about Boris Johnson not appearing on an interview with Andrew Neil, as nominal opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn had actually done earlier in the week. This requires about 8 levels of unpacking, now I think about it, because there's so much going on there and so much happened over the course of the week.
Yeah, that's
right. Okay, so we're not better off than America after all.
I think that, I mean, to be serious for a little bit, but, well, because of this, the terror attack that happened in London over the weekend, the BBC has now put out this statement that's saying that as a national broadcaster, its first priority has got to be to the audience. And in the wake of a major terrorist incident, the PM should be interviewed on the flagship Sunday programme, which is MAR, and that'll go ahead with nothing to do with Andrew Neil, and it's kind of bullshit.
It is bullshit because it's allowing him to be statesmanlike and avoid his responsibility for scrutiny. The BBC, even its, I think, most ardent defenders who I follow have basically said they have dropped the ball so much this election campaign.
Yeah, they have. I think they have.
Talking of dropping the ball this election campaign. So I've heard quite a bit about these Lib Dems putting out fake newspapers. And I saw some pictures on Twitter this week. They're actually really realistic.
Yeah.
So they're putting out the York Gazette or something with pictures like, Joe Swinson about to take the leadership. And the bit about produced by the Lib Dems is like in tiny, tiny text.
But this happens every year.
Yeah, I was going to say, the one thing to say about this is the Lib Dems aren't the only ones doing it.
I remember last year it was the Conservatives. They were putting out ads disguised as newspapers, as wraparounds on local titles. And it was even then it was criticised, so I don't understand why anybody goes back to this. I don't understand why the press who were facing like a trust...
They must just think it gets some kind of cut through. I don't know.
Well, it's very cynical if that's the case.
Did you just say that?
No, I'm quite confused about how they're allowed to do that. Like, the political advertising in this country is, to be fair, fairly tightly regulated. And yeah, I'm just surprised that there are no rules around like how I know they've got to say it's produced by them, but there's got to be rules about like font sizes or something. Okay, so WhatsApp has actually turned a profit from its business service in India a year after its business service launched. So we've not seen any of that over here yet or really much about what it's about, so we'll keep an eye on it.
I was going to say, what the hell's WhatsApp business service?
And Guardian chief exec David Pemsel has resigned from the Premier League top job before even starting after allegations about text messages to a former female colleague surfaced and were published by The Sun and The Times.
So he'll be back in a media job before too long anyway, right?
That's a weird story. Actually, talking about weird stories, did you see this thing about Zilla Bing Thorne selling shares in Future?
No.
And the stock price for Future dropped on news, I guess, that the boss was selling shares, £14 million worth of shares or something. Wow. And then just today I saw a thing that the shares had been sold without her consent.
What?
That she didn't know they'd been sold. It was an administrative error. The whole thing just sounds bizarre.
Okay, well, this is one we're going to have to come back to next week.
I think we will.
And the NYT has launched a new experiment to involve their readers in the reporting process by getting them to submit questions on a given topic.
Why?
So it's a way to...
Are you officially submitting that question?
Yeah, I'm officially submitting that question.
So they've effectively put out the call for questions around a given topic. I think this one's to do with climate change in California. And then they're going to broaden this out. And the idea is that they're going to get readers into the kind of reporting process in the same way they're trying to do with their flagship TV show, The Weekly, to show the shoe leather journalism that their reporters actually do and hopefully engender some trust. But they announced it in a really cringy way. The press release is kind of horrible.
Like what?
They were just like, we've always known our readers are the best, but we've never really shouted about it before.
All right.
Oh, dear. Talking of engendering trust, Facebook has issued a corrective label on a user's post at the request of the Singaporean government after they introduced new laws about fake news. So the notice, which is only visible to users in Singapore, says Facebook is legally required to tell you that the Singapore government says that this post has false information. I mean, apparently it was something a user posted about the arrest of a whistleblower and election rigging. So, yay.
That's kind of creepy. Platforms and publishers, the end of an era, is a report from the Tau Centre for Digital Journalism. The report confirms what we already know. Here's a little quote for you. The belief that the massive audiences platforms offer would lead to meaningful advertising revenue for publishers was a bubble and a distraction. And finally, publishers believe the scale game is over. Dun, dun, dun.
It only took 6 years. That's relatively quick.
The Skim is said to be on track to make $30 million in revenue this year, profitably.
That's good, isn't it?
But there have been a lot of reports this week that its growth has slowed, so it's looking for an investor or buyer to boost that. I would just say its growth has slowed on 7 million subscribers.
Yeah, we just said the scale game's over, what?
Yeah, but big number. Even if the scale game is over, big number is always the big draw for people.
I would be quite happy with 7 million subscribers.
I'll be quite happy with $30 million in revenue.
So this week I spoke to Andy Serwer, who is the editor-in-chief of Yahoo Finance. Just a very quick note that we had some headset issues in the first half, which is why he suddenly sounds clearer halfway through. Thanks to Chris for his techromancy in getting it all fixed. So I started by asking him what he'd done to grow Yahoo Finance to be the biggest online finance publication this year.
Well, you know, we have this great background here in history, really, where we've been around for almost 20 years, and we've been really the go-to place to provide financial information and news by having this world-class data so people can look up stocks, and then aggregating content from partners like Bloomberg and Dow Jones and Reuters, etc. But what I've really looked to do here over the past 4.5 years that I've been here is to really build out our original content and to elevate the platform, elevate Yahoo Finance, and to make it part of the conversation. And I've done that by trying to do breaking news, do newsmaker interviews, and to focus on social media off network and try and be part of conversations that way as well.
And that's worked as a growth strategy for business media on platforms.
Absolutely. I mean, you can't ignore that at all at this point. And I think there was actually some thinking here historically that was a little bit unhealthy, because we had this huge, you know, what used to be called a portal, right? And people would just simply come to Yahoo back in the day. And there was still some legacy thinking along those lines. But of course, we need to distribute our content not only on Facebook and Twitter, but also LinkedIn and Reddit and Instagram and the places where our audience goes. And our new audiences go.
Do you find that there are platforms that perform better than others for financial news?
Oh, sure. You know, no question about that. And I mentioned LinkedIn. That's very important, obviously, for business people. And it's really become a place where content is recognized increasingly. Less so, as you might expect, for instance, on Snap. It's just not the place that our audience or even prospective audience necessarily thinks of going for business news.
So in practical terms, you've got quite a big team at Yahoo Finance.
Right.
What's it like actually heading up a team of that size, producing that much content?
Well, it's really gratifying. And there's a lot of people doing a lot of different things. So coordination is hugely important. The people who are running the front page of Yahoo Finance, both on desktop and mobile, are like air traffic controllers. They're monitoring the markets real time and trying to prioritize what's important, trying to get out ahead of what's going to happen during the day, but then responding real time to what's going on, and then assigning stories to our team or putting partner stories up, and then sort of moving back and forth between partner stories and our originals. And then if the news warrants it, sending out alerts to our 70 million core users. There's 70 million core monthly users here at Yahoo Finance, and 90 million if you include the properties that roll up to us here at Verizon Media Group. So that's hard. Then at the same time, it's sort of the other end of the news spectrum. We have people working on enterprise stories, both in terms of text and video, and they're doing things that would take, you know, the usual weeks and months. And sort of in between, we're running a live television-like network, over-the-top, live video, linear programming of the financial markets. And so we're sort of going back and forth between the text reporters who are doing these stories, and then they're going on air and reporting them. So it's a lot of fun, and I think it's an incredibly attractive environment. We've had great success at bringing some incredible talent here, and I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that it is so new, digital first, digital only, and there's a lot of experimentation, quite honestly, that goes on here, and that's really exciting.
So, I mean, the lines between being a traditional publisher and being a broadcaster have almost completely gone with you guys then.
I think that's right. And, you know, people say that it's important for journalists to be able to wear multiple hats today. And here you almost pretty much have to, because everyone on our team either writes or reports or goes on camera or produces video pieces or works on podcasts or edits stories or works on the social media team. And most people do a majority of those things and love it. I mean, it's just really exciting to be able to try your hand at all these things. And then what we like to do is to see how people work out and sort of play to their strengths. And if people are particularly good at understanding how Twitter works, well, that's where they're going to end up. And of course, we need to assign people to where we have needs, and we hire people for where we have needs, of course, as well. But there's a certain amount of finding yourself here, which is really, really cool.
And talking, you mentioned new technologies earlier. Are there any ways you're using things like automation or AI alongside the journalists?
Well, you know, it's interesting about AI because in a way we were sort of, you know, the original gangsters when it comes to understanding, you know, what's going on in terms of big data, because we're a legacy digital media property, right? And, you know, which sounds like a bit of a paradox, but it's really true because we've been around and we've garnered this massive audience. And so we're able to look and see what trends are taking place amongst our audience in terms of what tickers are they searching for. We never use that data in any way outside of Yahoo Finance in any way, shape, or form. And we're very careful about using it only in aggregate. And we use it for reporting. We don't use it in terms of any other functionality. So, but we'll say, oh, a lot of people are searching for GE stock, which surprisingly they're still doing. And so that's something that we report on air, that people are looking, you know, these are the trending tickers that people are looking at today.
And you've kind of got a long history in traditional kind of print magazine publishing and journalism. What attracted you to working in an environment like that where there is so much going on in so many different forms?
Well, I think it was coming here was really exciting. And I remember when Marissa Meyer and her team were first reached out to me about coming here, and it sounded like, frankly, a real breath of fresh air for me, because to be at a place which is digital first and digital only. And honestly, I'd spent a lot of time working in print where the business was declining, ad pages were declining, and boy, I just didn't want to have to deal with that anymore. But even more than that, just really trying to understand digital journalism, because I had done some of that at Time Inc., but it's nothing like here. And working with real, you know, bread in the bone product people and real people, real computer scientists, you know, in Silicon Valley and in Sunnyvale at Yahoo headquarters, people who really understand how the internet works, quite frankly, and then marrying that with journalism and media here on this side of the coast, frankly, it's just been really fascinating to watch these two worlds come together. And of course, it's still evolving. You know, people ask what inning we're in, and I'm like, the warm-ups? You know, it's just every week we learn new things.
And you've touched on it there, but business media is increasingly having to kind of diversify its revenue streams to keep up with declining ad revenue. What's your experience, both at Yahoo and more widely, been of actually putting things like alternate revenue streams into practice?
You know, well, obviously, you know, advertising is a very tough business. And what happens is it just people come up with amazing new ideas. I mean, first of all, obviously, the print part is dying. And what happens on the digital side is it just becomes commoditized. When people come up with new ideas, they'll come up with a new format for display, they'll come up with a new format for programmatic, and they're a hero for exactly 6 months, and then everyone else figures it out. And of course, that's true with native and branded and all that kind of things as well. And so that's why you're seeing people really being thoughtful, I mean, about subscriptions and paywall and freemium. And we have to do more of that here. We have a new subscription product at Yahoo Finance, which is based primarily on incremental tools and metrics. It's not so much focused on content, although it is a little bit, and we want to do that increasingly. So subscription is obviously key. And then revenue from live events, which is something I was very familiar with at Fortune when I worked there, when I was the editor there. That's obviously a big part of that franchise. That's really important as well. And to be able to understand how to have ticket sales and sponsorships be a part of the business mix is something we're going to be doing increasingly here, have been doing and doing more of.
I mean, I suppose business media has an advantage when it comes to things like live events, because there's always sort of conferences and things going on in business if there is value.
Yeah, there are a lot of conferences too these days, of course, and that's something. So we have to really make sure that what we're doing is differentiated, because there really is a plethora, right? And so, you know, we have this incredible scale. I mean, The thing that really differentiates Yahoo Finance is the technology and the scale. And if you put those two things together, you know, we're sort of in a category of one, that we are a digital native, digital first, digital only platform, and we're the biggest. So when you put those two things together, it really is a pretty interesting proposition. And we do that when we do, we talk about that when we do live events. So in other words, we say, you're going to be in a room in front of a couple hundred people who are business executives, yes, but then you're going to be live streamed to, you know, say up to 9 million people, which is, you know, what our DAUs are looking like right now. And that's a really compelling and cool thing. In fact, I mentioned that I was going out on stage with the CEO of one of the biggest banks in the world, and he said, how many people are going to be watching this? And I said, probably 1 million people. And he said, wow, I wish you hadn't told me that. So it's pretty awesome.
But I mean, of the 70 million that come to the site every month, those can't all be high-end business execs. So who else is kind of listening and tuning into this?
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, most of them aren't. That was what I'm saying. The live audience here in New York City would be business executives. Most of the people who come to Yahoo Finance are investors and people who want business news. So, and they want data and they want news about business. And I like to tell people that we really speak to American shareholders, to American investors. And that's another difference, I think, between what we do and some of the other properties, that I think some of the other business news sites are really big on the coast, big in New York and the Bay Area. And we're big there too, but we're also big in the flyover states, in the second tier cities. And so I think that there's a lot of people who have Yahoo Finance, you know, open on their desks at some point during the day, or checking stocks on their phone, whether they're actual stockbrokers even sometimes, but mostly they're just ordinary Americans who want to see, you know, check in on their financial well-being during the day.
We could do with a bit of that in the UK at the moment.
Oh, yeah, I know, right? Well, and that's interesting because obviously Brexit is a story that we're covering. It. And it's sort of interesting to see what kinds of stories resonate, because you might not think Brexit would be something that Americans are so interested in, but it turns out that our audience is, and whether they just see the politics linked to what's going on in America, or obviously they're interested to an extent from a business perspective, but I think there's curiosity and also a sense of, wow, this is kind of similar to many things that are going on in this country that make people interested.
And I think leading on from that there seems to be a bit of a, well, I mean, there is a big crisis in trust in journalism at the moment. And there's a lot of people, certainly in this country, I don't know about the US, that find it difficult to trust even business and finance news about what's actually going to happen. Have you seen that spill over into what you're doing at Yahoo? Like, do people trust what you're writing?
It's very interesting that you asked that. So fake news, and obviously that's a huge topic. And we're not sort of in the very crosshairs of that, the way
numbers don't lie, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, people try to make them lie, but it's harder. It's much harder. But not in the same way, I guess I meant, say, with regard to our colleagues at Yahoo News, and obviously at the New York Times and NBC, CBS, and the news organizations in the UK as well. But, you know, business news, a couple things. First of all, business news is adjacent to hard news. And we do a tremendous amount of stories, as I just mentioned, on Brexit and, of course, on Donald Trump. I mean, it's an economic story. And so it sort of melds and blends into that. So we do have people who accuse us of having bias. We have people who say we're left-wing and people who say we're right-wing, which, of course, means I guess we're doing a pretty good job. The historical fake news in business news, of course, is people who spread false information about companies who are, say, short sellers. They say, oh, there's poison in the milk. This milk company, you know, boy, you better watch out, and the stock drops, and turns out it's completely untrue. So we're always on the lookout for that. And we're always watching, particularly the partner content that we have. As I said, we aggregate all this content. And I want to make what I think is an important point. We aggregate material from not only those big companies that I mentioned, the Reuters and the Bloombergs and the Dow Joneses, but also dozens of smaller news organizations. And we vet them very carefully. And sometimes they make mistakes. We respond very quickly by saying, first, you need to contact that news organization. And if the story is wrong, we will take it down. So my point is that unlike some other places like Facebook, quite honestly, and Twitter, we are 100, we consider ourselves 100% responsible for what's on our platform.
Right.
And so I think that's a real important distinction.
What do you make of the accelerating pace of mergers and acquisitions in media? I mean, there have been a lot the last couple of months, especially in business media. Like, is this good for businesses in the future, or is it not a good sign?
Well, I think it really reflects just how much the business model is changing and how the forms of distribution are changing and how our understanding of what people want is changing. And I don't think it's going to end anytime soon. I think that a lot of people have misconceptions about how easy it is, perhaps even, to create a digital media company. And part of that is because there's simply so much capital sloshing around in the world right now. So it has been. I mean, this is actually not so true in 2019, but up to this year, it was actually relatively easy if you had some sort of track record to attract venture capital to build a digital media company. And initially, you could scale pretty quickly, pretty easily, and the media itself would consider you to be the latest shiny thing, so there'd be sort of glowing stories about you, and you'd grow, and then you could simply, you know, do some meetings with Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, and all of a sudden you were off to the races. Well, the problem is that, well, there are many problems. I mean, first of all, as we've seen, there's the fickleness when it comes to the social media giants. And, you know, Facebook and Google and Twitter can be your friend one minute and they'll just change the algorithm and you're dead. And we've certainly seen that. And then also, I think that growth is limited as well. Some people think, well, I've grown, you know, doubled this year and now I'm up 80%. So I can just sort of extrapolate and keep going. Well, you can't. There's a ceiling to many businesses. And also, you know, the world is awash in content. And so to be sustainably different is extremely difficult. And I think what it really comes down to is actual talent, actually great reporting, and actually an organization that has real structure and bones and values and understands what it's doing.
I mean, Yahoo's had its own set of problems in that regard recently. I think 2016 was a bit rocky. Is that all settled down now?
We have had problems here. And, you know, I think that they come in at least two forms. One, obviously, has been hacks. I think that's what you probably are referring to, data breaches. And obviously, that's a huge issue. It's been an issue with other large media companies or large digital technology companies, I should say, more specifically, not so much media companies, as well as a whole host of other kinds of companies. And that's been difficult and tricky. It hasn't come from our particular part of Yahoo. It's not from Yahoo Finance. It's more from other parts, search and mail most specifically. But still, it's affected us. It's affected our brand. And it's affected probably trust in what we're doing. I won't deny that. And the other thing is just being a company that, as I think I said, is a little bit older. And sometimes, you know, like any company, you can sort of get steeped in tradition and legacy thinking. And so, for instance, when it comes to thinking that people were just going to come to Yahoo, I think that has been a mistake. And so we figured out that we need to reach out to people and do things differently. So I think that those are things that, you know, challenges that we've had here, and I'd like to think we've addressed them.
That actually leads really nicely into one of my last questions, which is, where do you see the future of finance and business news actually going, and how are you making sure that Yahoo Finance is ready for that?
Well, obviously, one huge big answer is mobile, you know, and we are really heavily, heavily focused on that. Our app has been growing really nicely. It's just got super functionality. And it's really great. And then we're really keen on making sure that our programming is available on mobile. So wherever you are, anywhere in the world, you can just ping on the app and get our live programming. You can get stock quotes. You can get news. And so that is really gratifying to be at the fore there. And I think increasingly, you know, we're looking at other forms of distribution as well, which are, you know, it's sort of not completely IoT, but getting there, because we're talking about watches and we're talking about the world of audio when it comes to Alexa and Siri, and we're talking about podcasts. So wherever people are, you know, we want to make financial news available to them from Yahoo Finance. And so that's sort of our mandate. And, you know, we have to be a little bit careful. Like, we don't want to send people alerts every 5 seconds, you know, and because obviously, you know, there's fatigue there and you can do more damage than good. But we want people to be able to stay in touch, and we want to help them succeed and stay informed about their world.
And finally, we ask all our guests what the last thing is you read or watched or listened to that really affected you.
You know, I guess I'm kind of a nonfiction junkie. You know, it's actually interesting. I realized I was talking to someone from the UK, but I've just read this book by Ben McIntyre, The Spy and the Traitor, which is a true life story about a KGB colonel who ended up spying for MI6 and then had to be extracted from Moscow during the Thatcher era. And it's just an amazing book. I just love that stuff. And then, you know, I'm just saw The Irishman, which is incredible. I love that kind of stuff. And watched this TV show, The Deuce by David Simon. I'm a big fan of his. And then finally, I read The New Yorker, you know, every issue. And I love Masha Gessen and Jill Lepore and all the great writers there and all the great work that they do. So, you know, there's just so much content, so much to keep up with. I mean, never mind just like, you know, following everything that's on Twitter all the time, which is, you know, like an impossible thing. But the long form, the short form, it's all there for us to take in, right?
So our Publisher Podcast Awards have now closed. So we're going to be sorting through all the entries now to pass them over to our judges. And we hope to be able to release a shortlist and tickets in early January. So do watch out for that. We won't let you miss it.
And we've also been hard at work over the last couple of months writing Media Moments 2019, which is our look at all the key moments that have affected the publishing and media industry this year. So it's got chapters on everything from M&A to platforms to data to the revival of print. And that is arriving on What's New in Publishing on Wednesday.
Why have you not signed up for our newsletter already? I say this every week. Sign up for the newsletter. We also have a little survey going on at the moment. So if you can tell us what you think about stuff, we can make it better. You find a link to the survey on the website and in our Twitter feed, which is at Media Voices Pod. The website, by the way, is voices.media.
But until next week, when we're going to be back with a fantastic guest and maybe some more updates on our projects, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
Still stop Brexit.